If you're wondering about the smoky air and whether the rain coming in this week will clear the skies, we're wondering too. On Insight, the detailed forecast from the National Weather Service, two storms are moving in. I'll also talk with CAL FIRE Chief Mike Moeller about the potential impact on the air and the land. And we'll explore those air quality questions with Lori Cobza from the Sacramento Metro Air Quality Management District and CAP Radio's healthcare reporter Sammy Kayola. First, though, an update from reporter Mark Albert, who's been covering the campfire since it began. He's with North State Public Radio in Chico. And later, the unique exhibit of Ann Brigman's photography at the Nevada Museum of Art in Reno. I'll talk with the curator, Ann Wolf. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's Today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. In this Thanksgiving week, donations continue to flow to people in the Butte County wildfire zone. The mayor of Paradise, who was on our program yesterday, and a number of others are telling us cash is most needed now to meet and to manage the ongoing needs. Meanwhile, the bad air quality continues, at least for another day. It's forced many closures, as I'm sure you know, but there are two storms on the way. In this hour, we're going to explore a lot of details about the weather situation, the fire situation, and the potential impact. So let's start with reporter Mark Albert from North State Public Radio in Chico. Mark's been following the campfire since the first fire alerts on November 8th. You've heard him on our air before. And hi, Mark. It's great to have you back on Insight.
Good morning, Beth. How are you?
So tell me about the different aspects of activity happening there right now.
Well, the Sheriff's Office and CAL FIRE have lifted some of the evacuation orders around the region, sort of starting to repopulate some areas, but that is going quite slowly. The level of devastation is starting to become more into focus. There remain 699 people listed as officially missing. The death toll rose yesterday to 79 with the discovery of two more bodies. They have reduced the number of threatened homes to 14,500, which still remains pretty gigantic. We're expecting up in the foothills perhaps as many as 4 or 5 inches of rain beginning tonight and through Sunday. And officials are very concerned about possible debris flows, about ash flows, and damaging the wild salmon habitat in Butte Creek, but also creating all sorts of other disasters and making cleanup that much more difficult. It's also going to greatly complicate the search for human remains in the fire zone as the water makes the remnants more difficult to sift through.
Mark, there's this phrase, the deadliest and most destructive wildfire in California history, that I'm hearing repeated in news reports across the country, here in California and nationally as well. So teams are still searching for human remains. There's a story and a picture on the front page today of the Sacramento Bee. Tell me about that effort in this crunch time before the rain comes in.
Well, the Sheriff's Office and teams from around the state are sifting through the rubble looking for more remains, and they've stepped up efforts with the rains impending. I've tried to get on and go along with one of the crews now that we here at North State Public Radio are less focused on the minute-to-minute movements of the fire. So far, I have not been able to join one of those teams.
Let's talk about the FEMA center that's open. And with Mayor Jody Jones on our air yesterday, we talked a bit about that Walmart parking lot encampment, and she said some of the people don't want to move. So tell me about that coordination between people who are camping, FEMA trying to redirect people, and then future plans.
Well, you know, there's a bit of controlled chaos. You know, the people on the ridge from Paradise and further afield in the foothills, there's quite a bit of an independent streak, quite a bit of a libertarian leaning. People don't necessarily like government aid, and they're suspicious. They're suspicious about what the situation will be like in the shelters. I was down at the Walmart lot yesterday talking to quite a few people. There were concerns. There were rumors that there are armed guards and barbed wire, and that you'd be separated from your pets or separated from your partner. The authorities are attempting to cajole and encourage people to leave that Walmart lot. They say that the area will kind of flood. There were volunteers out there distributing pallets for people to pitch their tents atop of to get out of the water. There's a real dichotomy between this sort of wildcat, independent kind of refugee camp that's being supplied and by individuals, by, you know, loosely coordinated volunteer groups from the community versus the organized shelters elsewhere. The authorities definitely want to get people indoors. They're concerned about a norovirus outbreak at that site where there are just a few porta potties. There were discussions of disallowing the distribution of food or clothing there at that site by Sunday afternoon. That is still going on, to my knowledge. It's a delicate dance because obviously the authorities don't want to be seen as forcing people to do anything. I spoke to one woman who identified herself as a doing public relations for Walmart, and she said that the company is not going to force these people off of their property, that they're sort of taking a hands-off approach.
In the housing options for people, are they able to stay with their pets? That's, for some, a real lifeline.
Certainly. And at the Butte County Fairgrounds in Gridley, people are being allowed, I've been told at least, to pitch tents outside and to camp with their pets. The scale of this destruction is really quite astounding, especially for the region, and I don't think the numbers tell the true story. They've updated the list to 12,637 single-family homes destroyed and another 310 multifamily homes destroyed, and I'm not sure if those are duplexes or apartment complexes or condo complexes and how many units each of those 310 number represents. But unlike Sacramento or other regions in California, Butte County is fairly sparsely populated. There are not contiguous towns in which to resettle people. I spoke with FEMA representatives, and they said that, and city and county officials, and they say every option is on the table. They're attempting to acquire every vacant standing structure in the region to house people. Folks at the Walmart lot were concerned that they would be placed somewhere distant and that it would make commuting to any jobs difficult, if not impossible, or at least unaffordable. So there's a lot of questions, and I think that the information is not really getting out to evacuees as well as it could. There's a lot of misinformation, a lot of rumors, and a lot of unfounded fears. I spoke to a couple who have been living in the 1985 Nissan Sentra for over a week, and they don't want to. They don't want to go to one of the other shelters. They say that they are waiting to hear back from FEMA. They've registered with them, but they were renting a home for 20 years on a lease-to-own basis. They're either beyond retirement age or at retirement, and they lost everything. He said that their landlord gave them back $1,000, but everything that they've had is lost.
I'm talking with Mark Albert, a reporter with North State Public Radio. Mark, I want to kind of do a speed round here and get through a couple questions really quickly. You have a lot of information on your website about donations. It's in alphabetical order. I said at the top of this segment that cash is really important right now, just in terms of meeting those needs. Will you add anything that's important to know about the donation situation?
Yes, I was up at the Tico Airport where people have been donating just truckloads of pet supplies and pet food. At the evacuation centers, they're trying to turn away people donating clothes. The issue really is storage, and with the rains coming, they can't store these items outside. They'll get wet and ruined. They're really asking, they've been deluged with donations of all kinds,
right.
And what they really want now is cash.
Okay, next question. You describe being in the Walmart parking lot. Can you paint a picture for me? How many tents, how many people are living in that lot?
Well, you know, it's hard to tell how many people are in each tent, but I would estimate there are about 150 or to 200 tents up yesterday, sort of scattered around. There's a vacant lot next to the Walmart lot. There are also dozens, if not scores, of people camped out in their vehicles in the parking lot. It's, you know, surprisingly, it is fairly orderly. There are some transients that have moved in. I spoke to some evacuees who are complaining about having their shoes stolen or clothes stolen or other items. But for the most part, it's fairly orderly, and people are getting on quite well. However, after living there for this many days, there are a lot of frayed nerves and people snapping at each other as well.
Are there services there? FEMA has its center, and I get the sense that there are sort of pop-up help sites throughout the area. But again, I need a little more description of how people are able to access, for example, food and water.
Well, as I said, the volunteers have been bringing in food and water and other items. There's an endless slew. I spoke to evacuees who said they were gaining weight, that there was too much food. I spoke to some people trying to distribute food saying they couldn't find enough hungry people. On the flip side of that, there are bulletin boards advising people of the local assistance center, and that the county bus arrives every morning at 7 a.m. to bring people voluntarily to the Butte County Fairgrounds in Gridley. I spoke to other folks who said they've never seen a bus, so I really don't know how well organized things are, but it's certainly a wildcat effort there at the Walmart lot.
Okay, we've got this shift in weather coming. So are you noticing a shift in the presence of firefighters as we're now up to 70% containment, and anything with regard to anticipation of the storms?
Well, from what I understand, there are efforts underway to try to mitigate damage from possible landslides, mudslides, ash slides, and other debris flows in the area. Obviously, the fire occurred in the foothills, so there's going to be quite a few number of drainage avenues for debris to flow downward. But I have not seen a reduction in the number of firefighters around town. There are firefighters from Oregon and as you know, Loyalton, San Jose, pretty much all of Northern California and adjoining states as well, and including Nevada.
Okay, one more question going back to FEMA for a moment. I heard you report earlier this week about perhaps some temporary prefab sort of multi-housing units, something that could be done maybe not immediately, but fairly quickly to help the situation. Any more about that?
Well, I finally was able to reach a FEMA representative late yesterday after trying all day on multiple platforms. He was not particularly up to date on things, but he said that they were talking about RVs, they were talking about trailers, and they were talking about renting hotels, motels, any vacant housing, any standing structure that was available to house people. He didn't mention prefabricated housing, although I did speak over the weekend with the county housing director and our county housing authority director, and he told me that FEMA was looking for different sites to house to construct or to put 2,000 units of housing into 10 different villages of 200 units each. I have not been able to get any additional information about that.
And one more story that you've covered, it's a headline story on your station's website today, and that is the City Council approving an ordinance that prohibits price gouging by landlords and retailers. Is this an important concern? Is this just part of the process, or is there already evidence?
Well, I think that the City Council is normally reluctant to take such an extreme measure. It's certainly a pretty conservative body. However, the loss of housing in this region, in the county, we're talking about 15% of the housing stock in the entire county being wiped out. And unlike other in more metropolitan areas, there aren't adjacent towns with availability. We're surrounded by farmland and by orchards and rice fields. So it's a real crisis. And with the declining supply and higher demand from all of these people who are newly without homes, there's going to be incredible pricing pressure, I think, especially on housing, but then any construction services or other services. I heard from some evacuees being told that offered an apartment for $500 a month, but then learning that it was a bedroom in a four-bedroom house with four other families, and they felt it was a complete ripoff, that was something where people are going to be paying someone else's mortgage and living in a very cramped, crowded conditions.
Mm. Well, Mark, thank you for your ongoing reporting. We've been grateful to have your eyes and your stories from there for us. And I want to wish you a really restful Thanksgiving holiday. I wish that's something we could bottle and give to everybody right now.
Well, thank you very much, Beth. It's been an honor and a pleasure, and I am greatly looking forward to a day off whenever that comes.
Our wildfire coverage continues after a short break. That was Mark Albert, reporter with North State Public Radio. There's much more at capradio.org. We're going to talk about air quality and that incoming weather change after a short break. This is Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. By tomorrow, a stretch of Northern California is forecast to be in rain, and that's the start of two storms that are moving in from the Pacific. The earliest rain could be tomorrow morning, and that will be a critical change for everyone, especially people in the campfire zone. So let's start with the forecast. On the phone from the National Weather Service is meteorologist Jim Matthews. Hi, Jim.
Good morning, Beth.
I gave just a bit of an outline. Will you fill in more of the details on what's coming?
Sure. You're exactly correct. We do expect rain to begin to move into the Sacramento area and the Butte County area tomorrow at this time, certainly by the noontime, by the lunch hour. And the first system is expected to bring about 1.5 inches of rain over the campfire area. A little bit of an increase in wind, not too windy. The second system you mentioned, Thursday into Friday, is going to bring some heavier rain, over 3 inches possible in the campfire area, and stronger winds. There could be some wind gusts, 30, 35 miles an hour in that area, and any of those dead trees could be blown over in that area as well.
So the timetable really is this first one tomorrow, and then by the end of the week, later on Thursday, the second phase, correct?
Yes, probably Thursday, late afternoon and evening, both areas will see an increase in wind and rain. So Thanksgiving for the Sacramento area might start out not looking too bad. Cloudy skies, maybe some light showers around, but the rain will increase during the evening hours and overnight.
What's happening with the temperature, Jim? Because I saw maybe 4 to 8 inches of rain up in the Sierra. I don't know whether any of that might be snow at the upper elevations.
Oh, yeah, that's going to produce some snow on I-80. We do have a winter storm watch out for the I-80-50 corridor, and we will likely upgrade that to a warning in the afternoon forecast. We're looking at maybe 4 to 6 inches by Wednesday night along the I-80 corridor around Donner Pass, another 5 to 7 Thursday night, and another 5 to 8 Friday night. So that area, maybe 14 to 20 inches of snowfall expected from these two storms.
Wait, Jim, say that again. Wow.
Yeah, it could be with these two storms and some lingering rain into and snow into Thursday, we're looking at 14 to 20 inches of snow along the I-80 corridor.
Wow, so this is the first major winter snowstorm. Is this opening the door to our winter weather pattern in the north?
Well, it could be. We expect maybe some drier weather over the holiday weekend. And I haven't had time here today to really look at the extended forecast much, but certainly we're going to have a noticeable change in weather over this Thanksgiving holiday.
Isn't that the truth, Jim, that right now everybody's kind of coping day to day or hour by hour? So I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, and we really feel for the people who are really struggling with the fire situation in Butte County as well as all of California. It's we know it's very tough on them, and we try to do our best to give them the best weather information possible.
Yeah, there's such a mixed sense, the good and the bad about this weather change coming. All right, Jim, happy Thanksgiving to you and your family. Thanks to you and everyone at the National Weather Service for always being available for us.
Well, thank you very much, and happy Thanksgiving to everyone in the listening area as well.
All right. That is Jim Matthews, meteorologist with the National Weather Service. On the phone is CAL FIRE Chief Mike Moeller, and this is the critical conversation, Chief. How are you preparing, and what could the impact be?
No, absolutely, Beth. And like you said, the rain is a welcome sight. But what we were looking at is, as the National Weather Service partner just explained there, is some of these areas get over the burn area could get 3 inches of rain. So CAL FIRE has dispatched what we call watershed emergency response teams. And these are actually dispatched within the first 10 to 12 hours of the actual fire, where they start building what we call inundation maps. But we are leaning forward, preparing for possible debris flows, and then also runoff from the structures that have been destroyed, because what's called an ash flow. We're working with Public Works to contain that also.
Some of the evacuations are being lifted. We heard that from Mark Albert earlier in the hour. With the rain coming in and maybe debris and mudslides and people moving, what's the wisest coordination at this point?
No, absolutely. And that's a great point. So anybody that goes into a repopulated area, we ask to please, the rainstorms are coming. We're working very closely with the sheriff's department and local law enforcement to provide what we see as what we would call inundation maps. But we ask the public to be very cognizant, to not wait till the last minute. If the rain starts to get heavy, you're out near your property or your home, it's just best to get out of that area as the storm passes, because they can, these can, as we saw, unfortunately, last year in Montecito, these flows can be very, very dangerous.
Chief, could I get your take on the water coming in on top of the burning fire and the additional smoke that this could create, at least temporarily?
Yeah, so in initial stages, anywhere we have any type of smoldering vegetation, trees, larger timber that may be still smoldering, even some of the unfortunate structures that were destroyed, they will produce smoke, but that will be a very short-lived incident, because once that rain soaks that area, that smoke will dissipate rather quickly, especially with the way that these storms are spaced out. So at the initial, yes, it will produce some smoke, but all in all, this is really going to scrub and clean the air and hopefully bring our air quality back to where it needs to be and get people back outside.
And tell me what it will do for containment of the campfire.
Oh, this will boost the numbers increasingly. Like I said, this is a large fire, you know, over 151,000 acres. So when we talk about 100% containment, that's a lot of ground to cover. But again, this morning, happy to report we're at 70%, but I can tell you the rain will expedite that containment number, especially the type of storms that we're looking at.
Do you have a projected date for containment?
I would say, well, you know, cautiously optimistic. We'll see what this rain does in the wind, but we're hoping by early next week. Again, a lot of area that we still have to access. It's difficult, but cautiously optimistic. Early next week, we're looking at it, if not sooner.
And the bigger question, Chief, is because this is a sizable, finally, rain event, two storms that are coming, what does this do overall for the wildfire risk in the north? And I know that's a separate question from Southern California.
No, absolutely. It does. Once we get some rain on the ground, and we used to look at like 2 inches of rain, we would lift what we would call what we'd call peak. But due to the drought conditions, the fuels react differently. But it will definitely diminish the fire risk, but we will not at any time decrease any type of staffing. We will be at full staffing until we know exactly, but this will definitely improve decrease on the fire risk, especially with the amount of snow that we're hearing that the Weather Service is predicting, and the way that these storms are spaced out. We're not just getting one deluge. This is actually spaced over, so the ground actually has time to absorb that moisture. So it will decrease fire risk, but as you know, Beth, we're on the phone year-round that people, you know, please be aware that we're still in what we call fire year.
So let me get you to clarify that, because if I'm understanding right, you're telling me that the scenario is that one storm alone isn't going to do it right now.
That's correct. Now, we need several storms, several inches of rain spaced out where we're not just deluging the ground. And that's how we get through our fire risk. It's we need these spaced out continuous rainfall.
All right, Chief. Well, a happy Thanksgiving to you, to your family. Thanks for all the work by the first responders. And again, for always making time for us.
No, absolutely, Beth. Thank you for having us, and happy Thanksgiving.
That is CAL FIRE Chief Mike Moeller. There is more fire coverage at capradio.org. After a short break, we're going to talk about air quality issues. Cap Radio reporter Sammy Caola will join me. This is Insight on Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. We have been talking about the concerns of air quality with the ongoing California wildfires. The rain, as you just heard, is going to help clear the skies. But in the meantime, there are ongoing questions. In a few minutes, Cap Radio reporter Sammy Caola will join me with some of her reporting on this topic. Now on the phone with us is Lori Cobza, communications specialist at Sacramento Metropolitan Air Quality Management District. Hi, Lori. Thanks for making time for us today.
Hi, Beth. My pleasure.
Tell me about the situation in Sacramento and then expand it west to how the Bay Area is.
We are definitely seeing improvement here in Sacramento County and the Sacramento region. Downtown Sacramento is still, unfortunately, in unhealthy on the air quality index, but we are seeing dramatic improvement from what we had over the last several days.
Can you say that by the numbers? What do you call healthy, and what is Sacramento today?
Sure. Downtown Sacramento, the monitor that's down there, is currently reading a 157 on the AQI, which is in the unhealthy category. The Arden Arcade monitor is reading 124, which is in unhealthy for sensitive groups, which is the orange category. The other monitor that is in orange is Vacaville. It's at 112. And then the majority of the other monitors are in yellow,
I know,
which
you
is moderate.
Moderate. You don't really look upwards toward the Sierra so much, but there is a point at the elevation when the air clears. Do you have any information about that today?
No, it's been following a typical pattern, however. Once you start to get higher up, over 4,000 feet, the air quality has been much improved. So as people are heading up Interstate 80 or heading way up Highway 50, up into the Lake Tahoe area or up into Truckee and Tahoe City, that type of thing, the smoke has been much lower than it has been down here in the valley.
The conversation today has been that when this rain comes in, even though there might be a bit of initial smoke from rain on the fire, essentially the air clears much more. So will you add your perspective to that?
Yes, we'll be having updated information on that in the next hour or so, but I can tell you that when we do start to have rain, it will reduce the smoke in the Sacramento Valley. So all of the sites in the Sacramento Valley and the Sacramento region will start to see improvement once that rain hits. I would like to caution, however, that the rain might be sporadic. I'm not sure about the consistency in every part of the Sacramento region. So there still could be lingering smoke in spots that have not had substantial rain.
Lori, how accurate are our senses in terms of gauging unhealthy air? By what we see, by what we smell, maybe by what we feel or taste in terms of the air?
I think when it comes to how sensitive a person is going to vary from person to person. We always say that if you see or smell smoke, especially smell it, that you need to take steps to protect yourself and go indoors. The reason the smelling is so important is because it's the fine particulate matter 2.5 microns or less, that we are most concerned with. And that fine particulate matter is microscopic. And by being microscopic, it's invisible. You cannot see it. And it is so fine that it can not only get into the lungs, but it can also get into your bloodstream. That's the biggest concern, is once those little particles get into the bloodstream, what they might do throughout the rest of the body, including cardiac conditions. So you see, you smell smoke. We always recommend that people go indoors. And that's important at any time during the year, Beth. It isn't just right now when people are very concerned, and rightly so, about the wildfire smoke impacts. But here in Sacramento County, we are very concerned with wood smoke on a fall-winter basis that comes from wood-burning fireplaces and wood stoves. I've said before, smoke is smoke. It does not, you know, particulate matter is particulate matter. And that's why we have a no-burn program in Sacramento County called Check Before You Burn. And I can say that for the last several days, as well as today, we are in stage two, all burning prohibited. For anyone in Sacramento County who wants to use a wood-burning fireplace or wood stove, the answer is no. It's prohibited because there's enough pollution in the air already.
And just to let everyone know, those spare the air alerts kick in above 127, since we're talking about numbers, correct?
Actually, the Spare the Air program for the Sacramento region is only during the summer. So a Spare the Air alert for Sacramento region is related to ground-level ozone or smog. Then that program runs from May through October. Once we get into the fall and winter season and we're talking about particulate matter, for Sacramento County, it's Check Before You Burn. Yolo Solano has a Don't Light Tonight program. The Bay Area has what they call Spare the Air Tonight, but that's the Bay Area, although we're all concerned with the same thing, wood-burning fireplaces and wood stoves.
Right. So this morning, I wrote myself a Post-it note to change my air filters. We've all been cautious about this over the last 2 weeks, and even though changing filters might not happen on a monthly basis, how important is it right now to make sure that we change some of what's been going on filtering in our homes over the last 2 weeks?
I would strongly encourage everyone listening to replace the filter in their homes. And you will be surprised at how much particulate matter and gunk, if I can use that technical term, is going to be attached to that filter. We have seen reports of people who had just put in a new filter like 2 weeks ago, and they've now removed it, and it was white, and now it's completely black. So it's doing it, you know, they're doing their job. They're filtering out the particulate matter so it doesn't get into the home. So with the wildfire smoke and the severity that we have witnessed in the Sacramento region, always err on the side of caution is my motto, and I think that people should just go on to their local hardware store or home improvement store and get a new filter and put it in.
And while they're at it, one last note about monitoring air quality in your own home. There are a lot of options to do that.
There are. There are an awful lot of options. And we don't promote one or the other. There are many particulate matter monitors that exist out there. And one of the things that has been really quite fascinating for us is the South Coast Air Quality Management District actually has a research lab. And they will test these low-cost air quality sensors, and they put that information up on their website. So if anyone listening is interested in seeing the variety of low-cost sensors that exist out there and wanting to have information on how they've been evaluated and what they actually do reduce within the home, I encourage you to go to the South Coast Air Quality Management District website and check that out. And specifically, it's www.aq-spec.org. And our partners down at the South Coast Air District have been doing a phenomenal job researching these for several years now.
All right, Lori, that was a perfect segue to Sammy Kaola, our healthcare reporter who's standing by. Happy Thanksgiving to you. Thanks for your information today. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, it's always great talking to you too, Beth. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
You too. That's Lori Cobza, the communications specialist at Sac Metro Air Quality Management District. Sammy Kaola is in the studio. You just heard all of Lori's information. She mentioned one of the many groups that you've been talking to in the last couple days.
Oh, so she just mentioned the South Coast Air Quality Management District, and I found their little assessment of these monitors that you can use in your home to figure out what your air quality is inside. And so if you need that link that she mentioned, it's actually in my story, which is at capradio.org/wildfire.
All right. Talk more about the experts that you spoke to about air quality and its effect on us both short-term and long-term.
Yeah, so I've been trying to speak to as many people as I can because there are a lot of different opinions about sort of how this is affecting our health and how this will affect us in the long run. So I spoke to the California Air Resources Board. I spoke to a physician from UCSF, a pulmonologist from UC Davis. I spoke to the UC Davis Air Quality Research Center, and I also spoke to Sacramento County Public Health.
Wow. How wide-ranging was their advice?
Well, everybody has the same basic recommendation, which is stay inside by all means if you can. You know, if you don't need to be outside, don't be. If you need to be outside, if you work outside, or if you, you know, just have to be walking a lot, then they're advising the N95 mask. That's essentially the only mask that will protect you from this air.
I think we've become heightened in our education about masks lately and about air filters, too. There's a particular filter that's important.
Right. That is the HEPA filter. That means high efficiency particulate air. There are a couple different varieties that you can buy. You just want to make sure it has that HEPA certification.
Okay. Short-term health impacts of wildfire smoke. I think a lot of people have experienced even a mild headache for one symptom.
Yeah, our producer Cody Drabble was just complaining to me about his headache. You're probably hearing that a lot. You're maybe experiencing it yourself. Headaches, runny noses, itchy throats, coughing, chest pain, and also just fatigue. Those are some of the big ones.
All right. The short-term effect, any deeper in our bodies?
So for people that have a pre-existing condition like asthma, heart disease, or COPD, as Lori was describing, these are very small particles. They can get into the bloodstream and cause inflammation. If you're a healthy person, the inflammation will be bothersome, but it will go away. If you're someone who already has a respiratory issue, this could be hitting you pretty hard. So I talked to Dr. John Balms. He's from he's a board member, California Air Resources Board. And he says the folks that are outside in this smoke all day who already had a respiratory problem, they could see maybe a permanent worsening of these conditions. But for most people, you're going to be fine after the smoke clears out.
Mild irritation that most of us experience will be gone and we will be fine. You know, fires are episodic events, and so there's not chronic exposure, so we don't know if, you know, 2 weeks of exposure to this level of air pollution from wildfires is going to affect the lungs, but I would say it's very doubtful. In terms of cancer, I would say that none of the public that's exposed to this fire will get lung cancer because of this fire.
So basically what he's saying is this is not like some other countries where pollution is a year-round issue from factory smoke and diesel fumes where it's heavy, bad air all year, year after year. That, we know, causes major respiratory problems on a population level, causes birth complications. But just, you know, 10, 15 days of bad air here in California once a year probably will not have that effect.
You found that physicians at Sutter Health and UC Davis Health were not reporting a spike in people coming to the ER. However, this one group of people that everybody seems to be concerned about is the youngest, the kids. So let's talk about the concerns with children.
Yeah, children are a little different because their airways are much smaller and they breathe much faster. So they're sort of getting more of this stuff more quickly. And because they're young now and they have decades and decades to live, they're going to get more of this in the long run. I talked to Dr. Gina Solomon. She's a professor at UCSF, and she used to oversee a pediatric environmental health specialty unit there. And she says she's worried about them.
Kids also, in some cases, can be primed to asthma. Particles that create an inflammatory effect can interact with common allergens in the air and make people develop new allergies that they didn't previously experience. This has been well described with particles like diesel exhaust, but can also happen with other kinds of particles in the air. Kids have a much longer lifetime ahead of them, and their risk of lung cancer over the long term with exposure to particulate matter over and over again becomes a concern.
So she actually cited for me an interesting study that compared children who grew up in Los Angeles when the pollution was very, very bad to children who grew up in Los Angeles a little bit later when the pollution was a little lighter. And the children who grew up in the dirtier air, their lungs did not develop as fully. They had weaker lung function as adults than did the children who grew up in the cleaner air.
Well, I do notice that a number of the experts said, I don't know, or we don't know, or there are things we don't know, which means there's more study needed.
Absolutely. So, you know, that year-round kind of diesel pollution that we talk about, we've got lots of data on that that's been around for a long time, and people are in it year-round. But wildfire smoke, you know, these longer seasons are still somewhat new to California, so we don't necessarily know what that's going to look like 20, 30 years from now. At UC Davis, they are starting to do that work. They have actually ashes from last year's Santa Rosa wildfires, and they're testing that ash to see what's in it, whether they're, you know, burnt plastics or pesticides from farmland that burned. And they're also analyzing the blood, hair, and breast milk of women who were pregnant during that wildfire to see if it is affecting their children.
Well, I'll go back to something you said at the beginning, and that is that all the experts had the same basic advice to stay inside if you can. And thankfully, the rain is on its way.
Yes, it should all be over soon.
Thank you, Sammy. That is Cap Radio's healthcare reporter, Sammy Cayola. Happy Thanksgiving to you and yours.
Thanks, Beth.
This is Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. More than 100 years ago, a young woman traveled back and forth from her home in the Bay Area to the mountains of the High Sierra, and the reason she did that was to make photos. Her name was Anne Brigman. She was a pioneer in her time, and an exhibit now at the Nevada Museum of Art and two accompanying books are paying tribute to what she did. On the phone with us is Anne Wolfe. She's the deputy director of the Nevada Museum and the curator of this major retrospective of Anne Brigman. Her life and her work are on display through January 27th. Hi, Anne. Glad to have you on Insight.
Hi, thanks for having me today.
Describe more about who Anne Brigman is and why more people aren't aware of the work she did.
Well, Anne Brigman is so little known to so many of us, and that's unfortunate, but she really was truly a visionary photographer of her time who lived and worked in Oakland and the Berkeley area. And I think, you know, poignantly, she began making photographs in 1901, but in 1906, when so many of her friends suffered such great losses in the earthquake and the San Francisco fire of that year, she didn't go to the Sierras to escape that, but she went for transformation, and she found this opportunity for transformation in nature and in the mountains, and that's where she came to make some of her most powerful photographs that are still unknown to so many of us today.
Will you describe some of the work? And we've posted some images on our website. I'll sum it up by saying that she tried to morph her soul and her body with nature. And so her portrait work was nudes, and her subject, I'll let you take it from there.
Sure. Anne Brigman was a reader of Walt Whitman, a reader of Edward Carpenter's writings and poetry, and she believed strongly that the human body could be, the human body was embodied in nature. And so when you look at her photographs, oftentimes there's a human figure, most often a woman, either herself or her friends, entwined with trees or alongside boulders. And she was a pictorialist photographer, so there's a very much a moodiness to these images. They're a little bit out of focus. They're a little bit fuzzy. They're, of course, black and white, and she did this purposely because at this time, as a photographer, it wasn't about taking a documentary photograph. It was about trying to create kind of a fine art experience. It was trying to create emotion in her photographs, and that's what she did in the mountains. She writes, she's not just a photographer, she's also a writer and a poet, and she writes vividly about taking the stagecoach up from Sacramento, up what is now Highway 50, camping in the municipal camp there, Camp Sacramento, right along the highway, and then going up to Echo Lake. And via Echo Lake, she would enter into what was known as Desolation Valley, which is now Desolation Wilderness. And she would photograph herself and her friends nude up on the granite flanks of Desolation Valley alongside, you know, these ancient junipers and ancient pine trees, and really became known for that type of work.
I think the audience and the intrigue about her work today would probably astound her. Can you give me some of the feedback from people who have come through, witnessed the exhibit, and talked with you about it?
Sure. So much about Anne Brigman is really the story of, you know, what it means to be a visionary woman working ahead of her time. She was a photographer who probably the first woman in the world to photograph herself nude. And this was in 1905. This was before women had the right to vote. This is a story of how Anne Brigman found her power and her voice with the camera. And that resonates with a lot of not just women, but individuals, how you come to find your voice. And she, the idea of struggle and struggle in her life and struggle to define her own identity as a woman working in the early 1900s is really a big part of her work. And she identified the human struggle with the struggle of those trees eking out their existence up in the upper elevations of the Sierras. And you know, people leave this exhibition oftentimes in tears, really surprisingly. And I think, you know, we connect with Anne Brigman on multiple levels, whether you live in the San Francisco Bay Area, whether you've made that journey to the mountains year after year to find some type of transformation or renewal, or whether you've struggled within your own world to find your voice. You know, Anne Brigman definitely struggled to be recognized as a woman artist during her time, particularly in her relationship with Alfred Stieglitz and artists on the photographers on the East Coast who saw her work a little bit and interpreted it a little bit differently. But it's that idea of struggle, I think, that resonates with so many of our visitors. And they often leave the exhibition choked up, which is something we don't often see in our shows.
When she died in 1950, was the concept of feminist art or feminist expression even part of life yet? And do you know how she saw other people seeing her work?
Sure. So I think we would now define Anne Brigman as one of the great proto-feminist photographers of our time. The term feminist art didn't really emerge until the late 1960s or 70s. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's because after World War II, we have sort of this return to this post-war conservatism and more traditional values. And then by the 60s, the civil rights era and Vietnam War, we have more, protest and feminism emerges. And so that's when women start to use the camera yet again to photograph themselves nude in the landscape. We have artists like Judy Dater and Judy Chicago who are going out into the landscape outdoors and kind of reclaiming their bodies and their selves and kind of wanting to be a part of nature. And so it really takes 70 years for the world to catch up with what Anne Brigman was doing in 1905. And that in its own right is a spectacular story. We'll have Judy Chicago, the great photographer, here in January to talk a little bit about that.
This is such an amazing retrospective, perhaps the biggest ever, on Anne Brigman. And how did you pull this collection together with pieces from many collections, Anne?
Well, about 5 years ago, we organized an exhibition on the art history of Tahoe and Donner. And in that exhibition were Anne Brigman's photographs, and they were perhaps some of the most popular and appreciated images in the exhibition. And they happened to belong to the great photography collector Michael Wilson out of London, who happens to be the owner of the James Bond franchise. He produces all of the James Bond films, and he said, well, I have 80 photographs here in my collection. Please borrow them. And so we paired those together with photographs from the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Oakland Museum of California, the George Eastman Museum. And so this is by far, with 250 photographs by Anne Brigman, probably the largest exhibition of her work to date.
Mm. You have a number of events related to this coming coming up. I see three in December, which are conversations, docents, celebrations, and then, as you said, Judy Chicago late in January. But these are open to the public. I do want to encourage people to come to this museum because, as you know, we traveled our show there a few years ago, and it is a wonderful experience, Anne.
I do agree and would encourage that. You know, I think something about making the journey up into the mountains, making the trip to Reno, even Lake Tahoe or the mountains, is transformative for so many people. And, you know, to be able to visit a museum that is actually only about 40 minutes from where Anne Brigman made some of these spectacular images up near the old Donner Pass Road and up near Desolation Valley and Echo Lake is really a special opportunity.
So from public and private collections, the exhibit is Anne Brigman, A Visionary in Modern Photography. And Anne Wolfe is the Andrea and John C. Dean Family Senior Curator and Deputy Director at the Nevada Museum of Art in Reno. We'll post a link with more information. This museum goes back to 1931. This exhibit will continue until January 27th. I'm so glad we finally had a chance to talk about it with you, Anne.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
And that, again, is Anne Wolfe. We'll post the link at capradio.org/insight. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruiak. Our producers are Jen Picard, Cody Drabble, and Bert Johnson. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us.
It's just begun. 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 It's just begun.
It's just begun. At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.